There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weightloss. That's PlushCare.com/weightloss. PlushCare.com/weightloss.
I am two.
I am now recording.
I am now recording two.
David, it's so good to hear Perry's wonderful jingle again. I've missed it.
It's been too long, Ned. It's been way too long.
I tell you what's been too long. The 10 or 15 minutes of faffing around at our desks. You're sitting at your desk in Girona. I'm sitting at my desk in rainy Lewisham. And I can see you because we've managed to hook up a video link as well as hopefully an audio link. And it's just a sea of cables and echoes and weird bits and pieces. But it seems to be working, touch wood.
We're out of our depth here. And I tell you what, I'm quite impressed. I think the fact it only took us 15 minutes. Granted, we are a little bit like the most Generation X people ever trying to manage millennial technology. But I think we've done it. I hope so. Well, we'll probably find out afterwards that we haven't. But let's give it a go.
Yeah. So it's a bit of a reboot, isn't it, for Never Strays Far, because we're up at 2020 is kind of up and running now, isn't it? So, you know, we're going to try and be obviously much more regular than we were over the fallow winter months, because the racing started, and that's you know, it's proper. Or is it proper? Do you count the Tour Down Under as proper, I suppose, is the big question, David?
Yeah, I do. I mean, I think that's what's happened to the calendar now. There was a time where you would The you could almost do if you were to have an X and Y axis on a graph, the Y being the horizontal and the February to October, you could see the importance fluctuating on the X axis. So it would rise up to big races and it would drop down again and rise up, and it would have this lovely sort of curve through the year of kind of where races were training races, what were actually objective performance relevant important races, whereas now it just holds this one steady line throughout the whole year. Every race is important, and I think the Tour Down Under more than ever, it's every single World Tour race counts. Every single race counts.
Yeah, and it's remarkable actually the Tour Down Under happened at all, isn't it, bearing in mind the extraordinary bushfires in Australia just a couple of weeks ago and the cataclysm that looked like. And, you know, I know that Adelaide, which is where the race happens, wasn't as badly affected as obviously Sydney and the environs and the other coast. But still, it looked like it would be ill-advised in the extreme to let that race go ahead. And yet, you know, I know that some of the riders were tweeting various pictures and commenting on the fact that the route went through some scorched and burnt out vineyards and hillsides and all that sort of thing. But it was a slightly uncomfortable moment, wasn't it, when you consider how much science suggests that climate change has exacerbated the situation with the forest fires. Is it actually a thing that we should be pursuing, jetting people across the world, adding to the carbon footprint that's already so monstrous for a bike race? And then, you know, you wring your hands and then it happens and it's happened. And I don't know what I feel about it is what I'm saying, but there is a question that cycling increasingly urgently has to answer about that whole issue, I think.
Yeah, it's really interesting you said that. That hadn't occurred to me, because it was more, if I was to think about it, I'd probably think it was more important that it was raising awareness, because there's always lots of news when the fire's going on, and then the moment it's over, everyone forgets about it, moves on to the next disaster. And then it was just, my head was just thinking, I was just going round in circles while you were talking, thinking about that and going deeper. And if you think about it, it's almost 100 years to the year that Paris-Roubaix became a legend, because of it was racing through the war-torn northern France, and it became known as a Sunday in Hell. And it's like full circle. Now we're seeing it's a totally different issue the world's confronting, but people are using hell as a word to describe what they were riding through in South Australia and different places. And if the bike race wasn't going through there, no one else is going to tell that story right now, because it's a little bit off the radar.
David, is someone torturing a dog in the background?
Yeah, hang on a second. It's the dogs again. Hang on, I'm going to close my door.
Oh, brilliant. Okay. I guess ultimately, you know, unless you want the sport to stop, races will happen, and they will increasingly happen across the world, and that involves getting people across the world in aeroplanes, and there's no obvious way around that. But I suppose the hope that you've just, I think, articulated is that the smaller gesture ultimately leads to the greater good, and that people join the dots between bikes and as has been evidenced in the UK, and actually, you know, sustainable transport and bike racing. I can hear the dog still in the background. Bike racing being part of that. And it's a bit like, you know, people fret about the carbon footprint of the Tour de France, quite rightly, and say, you know, I've been part of this discussion recently. Can't you stop using helicopters and motorbikes and all that sort of thing? Can't you use electric drones and all that? Well, A, the answer is probably no, you can't technically. But also, the actual, you know, the bit of the Tour de France that televises it, the television OB, is tiny, really, in terms of its carbon footprint, in comparison with the hundreds of thousands of people who go and watch the Tour de France and who are welcome and who are part of it. So people focus on sometimes a really small part of a much, much bigger problem, don't they?
Yeah, we only ever see the tip of the iceberg, don't we? We don't see what's under the water. And whereas our case, I think cycling's... I think it's something that is being confronted now, and it's because of this climate awareness, the realization that we have to begin to build a circular economy, that we have to be sustainable, that actually we're reaching the end game of society's lifestyle, and it's time for us to really try and change this. And you know, and I think also within that, and just to make a note of it, because this is quite recent as well, De Koenig Quicksteps changed to 100% carbon neutral. I mean, that's a, you know, you got to love it. Giving it a go.
Well, the only reason I've got a slight laugh in my voice is it was slightly undermined by Patrick Lefebvre just a few days ago, tweet basically on the internet, on Twitter, trolling Greta Thunberg.
Oh, for God's sake,
well,
really?
I don't think, you know, well, he's Patrick Lefebvre, isn't he?
Well, so, he's that generation, know. Isn't he?
He is the, he's anyway. The ultimate.
So what happened, before we move on further, the women's tour.
Yep.
The women's tour down under.
It was important
this year.
It always is. It always is. It's a four-day stage race. The stages were divided between four different riders. The first two winners were kind of stalwarts of the Australian scene for the last couple of years. Chloe Hosking, the sprinter, she took stage one. And then Amanda Spratt, took stage two. But it was the American national champion who won the queen stage, Ruth Winder, who took stage three and basically sealed the overall win. And Simona Frapporti wrapped things up by taking stage four. So four riders sharing out the four stages. A lot of the bigger names, though, not present and not scoring just yet. So that really is a kind of season opener. And but it's the start of, you know, there've been a few high profile transfers, so it was a chance to get used to riders in different kits as well.
Yeah, it's also important that to see that it's Anglo-Saxon Anglophone, it's only really Britain and Australia that are embracing the women's tour to this degree at the moment, and Tour Down Under, and it's the first, they're using all their resources and putting it into the first race of the year, essentially. And so I think it is important in that sense. And it's a shame that they haven't got the full crowd there, because it's obviously Australia investing a lot into that. And hats off to them, and long may it continue.
Absolutely. And then that was followed by the men's Tour Down Under, which just finished a couple of days ago. And it was it's a world tour race. So what would you expect? It's a super strong start list, really, wasn't it? With a few, you know, the exceptions of Team Ineos, who always send a bit of a second string there. It's a glorified extension of their training program, isn't it? They build a training block around flying down to Australia and make it a bit of a warm weather training camp with a block of racing attached. But for a lot of other teams, it was you know, down to business straight away, wasn't it?
Well, we said about Team Ineos, but one of the notable exceptions this year was the fact they had Rohan Dennis on the team, who, after his controversial end to the season last year with his departure from the Tour de France and then this grey area of where he's going, what he was doing for the rest of the year, then it was a late official announcement that he was going to Team Ineos. I think it was in November, December, wasn't it? And he's come in and it looks like, and from everything we're seeing about him, he's loving the team. And I think that gave the team a motivation they haven't had in the past. But yeah, apart from that, I think it's essentially the usual suspects. Finally, we get to see Richie Porte fully conclude the Wollongong normal victory and actually win the race. Because poor guy, he takes it and he's starting to become a bit of a laughing stock in the sense that he does the same thing every year and then it just fizzles out from here on in. So hopefully this is a good omen for him.
Although the irony was that he won, he didn't win the Wollongong stage for once. He won the race, but didn't actually win Wollongong Hill for the first time in 7 years. That victory instead went to Matt Holmes of Lotto Soudal, who's a rider I've kept an eye on for, gosh, I mean, ever since he started, really, as a youngster on the British scene. He's a tiny lad from Lancashire. He's a kind of punchy Ardennes-style climber, but he had very few opportunities, really, on the British domestic scene to show himself off to his best strength. And his team folded, Madison Genesis, that he'd been riding for a number of years, to some success, by the way. He was the best British rider on the Tour of Britain last year. I think he finished top five in one of the editions of the Tour de Yorkshire that you and I commentated on. And things were looking pretty bleak for him, as they have been for a number of the British continental pros, until his agent, Gary McQuaid, pulled a rabbit from a hat, quite frankly, and got him a ride with Lotto Soudal. So to go from a defunct British continental team straight up to World Tour level, and then not just that, straight into a World Tour race, where he lined up alongside a pretty prestigious company. They took Thomas de Gendt to the race. They took a lot of their kind of quite big hitters, and most notably, of course, Caleb Ewan, who picked up a couple of stage wins down under as well. But Matt Holmes won the stage, the Wollongong Hill stage.
It's brilliant. I mean, I because even that caught my attention. I looked into it and was reading some of the report afterwards, and then reading even him saying, well, I don't really know what a summit finish is. I've been stuck in the UK the last 5 years racing there, and this is only the second time I've done it, and I think I'm suited to it. And you're like, brilliant. Since it's been quite a while since we've had like humility and honesty and transparency like that.
I mean, it's worth noting, and this isn't in any way to decry his achievement, but just to put it in its fullest and appropriate context, he won it from the breakaway. It's not like he didn't beat Richie Porte up Wollongong Hill climb, except
but I think any bike racer that's been in that situation when you're caught in the final after being in a day-long break by somebody who's... He put 25 seconds, Richie Porte, into the next of the GC races in that very short climb. It's like 3 or 4 Ks. So that means he was coming like a freight train. And just to be able to hold on to that, that's some achievement. And then he literally destroyed him in the last 200-300 meters.
Oh, didn't he?
So, you know, it's... Normally, and from 20 years of being involved in bike racing, when somebody does that on that stage quite early on, normally it's it bodes well, because that you don't hide in that situation, and I would definitely not take anything away from that victory.
Yeah, no, absolutely not. And I think, David, as well, that implies a real calm head and a great tactical analysis of how to race that as well, to win from a breakaway in that situation. It'd be fascinating. I'm going to try and get hold of him and interview him. He's still down in Australia and he's going to be racing the Cadel Ocean, whatever it's called, the Cadel Evans Great Ocean, whatever the hell it's called, race. But anyway, if I get hold of him, I'm going to drop an interview in after this chat and we can hear it from the horse's mouth. But I think he must have read that situation brilliantly, because he will have conserved whatever energy he could have conserved to hold back for the eventuality that he could just about stay with Richie and hold his wheel. And you know, that required thinking through, I think. At what point do I allow myself to be caught? Because if he'd been caught too quickly on that climb, he probably wouldn't have had a chance. So he must have just balanced it perfectly, how much effort to commit to the climb and how much to hold back for the finish.
Yeah, he raced it like a winner. He didn't race it for attention. He took his gamble. He didn't go for the big glory Hail Mary and spend a bit of time off the front in his own in a kamikaze attack. He made the call to get caught and then ride it intelligently and go for the win. So, as I said, that bodes well.
Yeah. He's a really nice guy. I remember talking to him years ago at some event and saying, how would you describe yourself, Matt? Who, you know, as a bike racer, what do you think you are, really? And he was 21, 22 at the time. And he went, I think I'm just a fat GC guy.
But so was Chris Froome.
Yeah, exactly.
So
exactly.
You know what I mean? Yeah. It's like, yeah, that's they're the best guys.
Fat GC guys.
Yeah, you just need to get some weight off them and they'll beat everybody.
Yeah, yeah. And also, I'm mighty relieved that it wasn't me commentating on that, because I think it was last year on the Tour de Yorkshire, I managed to misidentify him about six times. Oh. Madison Genesis riders kept attacking and I kept naming everyone in their team but Matty Holmes.
Yeah, and the reason, thank goodness you were. So it's like, 'cause I just get completely lost. Now, talking of Chris Froome, Ned,
yes,
you've recently been to see him.
Yeah, I have. I went out to Gran Canaria just this last week, actually, to go and see Chris Froome, kind of at his invitation, really. He's done very little media other than the kind of official statements that he's put out, like I'm going to be racing the UAE Tour, etc., and his various different bits and pieces. Quite understandably, he's kept a low profile media-wise. However, for Rouleur magazine, he has made an exception. And I remember going and interviewing him for Rouleur magazine in 2013, when he was yet to win the Tour de France or any... Well, actually, it turns out he had won the Vuelta. But it was really a kind of 7 years later, where are you at type interview. So he very kindly sort of gave me a day of his life in which I went out to Gran Canaria and spent the day with him, basically, getting a sense of where he's at and, I suppose more pertinently, what he's been through. Because I think what was most striking was the severe extent and gravity of his crash, which I hadn't really appreciated. I think a lot of people know the inventory of breaks that he suffered, you know, including two breaks to the femur, a fractured hip, a completely smashed up elbow that's full of pins and hooks and bits and pieces now, his right elbow, fractured vertebra, fractured rib, and punctured lung. So basically his entire right side of his body hit that garden wall at 60 kilometres an hour and just wiped out. He had excellent first responder treatment, both in the hospital in Rouen, where the accident happened, and then he was airlifted to Saint-Étienne, where, in his words, I mean, an army of doctors descended on him, and he suddenly realised the gravity of his situation. And I think reading between the lines, David, he was exceptionally lucky. Not only that, he kept his leg. There is an argument that had he not been Chris Froome, that leg might have come off. The internal bleeding was so bad. Mm. And actually, that he is alive, because the blood loss from internal injuries was substantial. So that's what he's coming back from. And as things stand, he is completely convinced he will make a full recovery. Not only that, and please, when this comes out in Rouleur, read all about it, but remarkably, David, he says that he will win. Not can, that he will win the Tour de France. I don't know. I came away just having no clue what to make of it, except for kind of this feeling of, if anybody can, it's probably him.
Yeah, I would not ever dare write him off. And I think there's a couple of things to that, because I didn't know that it, because he has been very quiet about it. He hasn't made a big deal out of it. And perhaps that says a lot about Chris as well. He doesn't want to dramatize anything. And I think he's still in that racing mindset. And the fact that you're leaving there and he's saying, and he honestly does believe that. And when you believe something, you may as well know it. And that's what he's aiming towards. And that's probably what's allowed his recovery. But there's another thing that I've noticed over for the last decade is the amount of times we hear this story of people who we still haven't had the paradigm shift regards how we look at medicine and how what happens to people. And over again, we see these athletes that end up in these crashes that would be career ending and, dare I say, sometimes life threatening. And yet within months, they're back on the bike. And within just a few less months, they're literally going back with this commitment to be if not as good as, but better than they were before. And that, and I think we're not quite up to speed on just what the amazing abilities are of doctors and hospitals and medical science as a whole at the moment. And then especially if you're on a team, one of these big teams, and a star like Chris Froome, who will get that extra treatment, who will get that special care. And when you get that, it's amazing what can happen. Now, that's one thing. But then to have that belief that he has, I think that says more about the person. That says more about this, the character that he has, the fact he's got to, the journey he's been on the last, not just the 7 years, but the 15 years. I mean, you've been visiting South Africa, and you know more than anybody about his upbringing and his life. This is probably the sort of thing that will motivate him and give him that's probably that fifth wind of motivation to go for it again. And literally the fifth wind to kind of do this, because he's now got something to fight against again. And I think he's the type of personality, he's got the type of character that needs to have that protagonist, that opponent. And he's at that degree now where the only opponent he's got left is himself. And it's literally now he's battling against himself.
Yeah, I mean, that's absolutely right. And it is remarkable, actually. I kind of, flying over there, I tried to put... to get my thoughts together about, you know, talking to Chris again after all these years and quite how many races he'd won subsequently. And thinking about it, David, I was thinking about there are three riders in particular who, in their own right, you would consider the best of a good generation of Grand Tour racers. Nairo Quintana, who's won the Vuelta and the Giro, Alberto Contador, who in many people's eyes is the ultimate racer, and Vincenzo Nibali, who's won all three Grand Tours. And Chris Froome has put them all in their box, one way or another. I know Contador got the better of him at the Vuelta, and Quintana on the odd occasion, but never at the Tour de France. Froome has ultimately overshadowed all three of those somewhat legendary figures in the world of racing. And he's not finished. And that is extraordinary, I think.
Yeah, I'd agree with that. I think, and we're already at that point where of this generation, this era, that we can have a little bit of hindsight, even though Chris Froome and Vincenzo Nibali are still racing, and Nairo Quintana. And Contador is an amazing bike racer, and there is the controversy that he bridged the two generations, and there's still that thing about Alberto Contador, but I'm a great fan of his style of racing, and I think he was until Chris Froome did the triple, the three Grand Tours back-to-back, the Tour de France, the Vuelta a España, Giro d'Italia, that was concluding in 2018. Yeah. And that, for me, that was then he just stamped his authority on that generation, because that was unheard of. And on the back of having won four Grand Tours, to want to go and do that, that was almost to cement that status. Not necessarily in the public domain, but within the peloton, within the sport, within the history, within the annals of professional bike racing and Grand Tour races. I think he's there, but evidently for him, he's not, because he's not got the five. And so he'll chase the five. And so, you know, that's what I mean. He's battling against himself, and he's battling against Bernardino, Jacques Anquetil, Eddy Merckx, Miguel Indurain. He wants to be with those four riders.
And he finally knows who they are as well.
Yeah.
He had no idea in 20. He didn't know. He had no idea, really, who Eddy Merckx was. And back then as well, he had no idea. I remember when I was doing the interview in 2013, he kept stopping and saying, "Now hang on, which one's Bardet and which one's Pinot?"
Oh, God, brilliant, isn't it? But that's part of the charm, isn't it?
It's part of the charm.
And it's also, and also I think what about this as well, this is classic professional bike racing. In that it's more than just the bike race. It's all these different narratives that are going on. It's this this huge... you've got the soap opera, the individual soap opera of each race, and perhaps even arguably each season. But then you've got the movie, which is the kind of the careers, the kind of the generational, the 5, 10 years, the 15 years, the individual human stories that are going on. And Chris Froome has now, he's transcended the kind of the box set, the soap opera, now he's on to the kind of the all-time epic movie. And I think he really wants to kind of be one of those.
I like it. It was really interesting. And I'm gonna start writing it down while it's fresh in the mind. And Ruler are going to print it fairly soon, because there's a lot to go on there. And what a story! What a comeback story that would be. What else have you been up to, David? I just before I let you answer that, in fact, that question I just asked you. I went up to the route announcement of the Tour de Yorkshire, ostensibly to catch an interview with Christian Prudhomme for this very podcast. And guess what? I screwed up the recording.
Yes!
Well done, me.
Worth the trip, then.
I went all the way up to Leeds and back. It was fine because I got roped in to do some of the presentation instead. So I did my bit for the Tour de Yorkshire. Now, I don't know, you probably haven't had a look at the route, have you?
I've looked savage. At the map. Savage. Yeah, it looks savage. I did look at it, and I did look at the map, and it's,
it's more savage. Of the same. More of the same.
It's Yorkshire looking hard.
There is, however, a slight concern that it's the last. Yeah, and that's all to do with, I'm afraid,
Harrogate.
You know, the Gary Verity, the Gary Verity reign at the Welcome to Yorkshire and the financial repercussions. So it's a race that has to start to wash its face financially in ways that it hasn't been doing. And I think just, testing the water a little bit up there, there is a slight fear. Paul Mason is the new chief at Welcome to Yorkshire, who is into his cycling. He gets it. Nice guy. But he's got a job on his hands to steady the ship there. And there's this horrible feeling that cycling and the big budget that is involved there might be the first thing that they'd look at in order to save on costs. So watch that space, and let's hope it's not the last one. But there we go. Anyway, so we'll be doing the Tour de Yorkshire again for ITV this year, David, and more races as well.
Paris-Nice. We're doing Paris-Nice. And that's coming around quickly. That's only a month and a half away.
I'm going out to Strade Bianche and then straight from Strade Bianche to join you in London, where we're... well, I've just revealed the fact we're not in France, but we'll be that in our usual remote manner from the London studios.
And you've got Langkawi in between as well. You're
going to
go...
I'm going to the Tour de Langkawi. Yeah, yeah.
I'm looking forward to hearing about that.
Did you race it ever?
No. Never did it. I didn't really race... tried to avoid racing January, February time as much as I could until they forced me. But... No, I think that'll be just... It's just been an interesting experience. I love Southeast Asia, so I think you'll have an interesting time out there.
Yeah, I'm hoping so. I told your friend and mine, Rob Hales, that I was going out to Langkawi, and he wasted no time in telling me that he won the opening prologue or something back in the day. And,
Crit. Prologue.
And, yeah, the
flat.
Something.
Something flat and short.
He won something flat. And there we go, yeah. Yeah, so Langkawi for me. What's coming up on your horizons? What are you up to?
At the moment, I'm going to a trade fair in Munich. So I'm doing that. Meeting with some interesting people from different companies. Chapter 3 stuff to talk to them about.
David, tell me about this whole... Because last time we met, you were buzzing with the direction of travel for Chapter 3 and, you know, the plan for the next few years and where it's going to go, or is that all embargoed?
Yeah, no, not at all. No, it's not embargoed, because I think it's really interesting. And you touched on it earlier when we were talking about Australia and us all having this awakening that we're to each of our contribution to the world at large and the future. And because of Chapter 3 and the fact that we've got this company brand that we own that's private, where we can control its destiny, I began to think, well, maybe what we should do is start to actually make this a fully sustainable company, is start to look into, and from 20, this doesn't happen overnight, and anyone that says it can is lying. It's from 2021 onwards, we really do start converting Chapter 3 into this evergreen company that is doing its very best to be not only a sustainable business regards how we build it, not looking for over-injecting with cash and leveraging and putting ourselves at risk and having to continuously fake things, but actually turn it into an ethical business that can last for a very long time, but do that through creating sustainable products and sustainable manufacturing, taking responsibility for where we source things from, knowing the people that grow it, make it, sew it, dye it, print it, how it's sold, where it's sold, when it's sold, the price points, and start to make everything really take an absolute social responsibility for what we're doing with this. Because I think that's so important now, and I think it's something that I'm starting to notice I'm doing it. If I decide to buy something, I want to know where it's from. It's how it was made, who the people are behind it, why they're doing it. And it's taken us as a company probably 5 years to get to this point to realize and understand the industry properly and see what actually, you know what, we do want to do this for a long time and we want to do it properly and we want to give something back. And so that's where Chapter 3 is going. It's the most exciting thing all of us have been. We were trying to find where we were. It's not just about making money. Obviously, it has to be profitable in order to work, but it's not just about that. We're willing to take the time to do it properly and do something that will last and do something that will leave the world a better place than when it started, because I think that should be the objective with everything, shouldn't it? So that's where Chapter 3 is.
Good on you. Good on you. I've just spent the morning having publicity photographs taken for my 2020 theatre tour. I'm touring again in the autumn, and I think there's 31 dates in the calendar.
31, whoa.
And we've got a title. We've got a title that is embargoed, and we've got some publicity shots that were done this morning, and they're embargoed. So we've got dates in the diary, we've got a name, we've got a website, the tickets are going to go on sale in February, and I haven't written a single thing, not a single joke,
absolutely fine, I have no doubt. But I tell you what we should do though, because I think this is going to be fun, to the people who listen to this, send in ideas for what they think the show might be called.
That's genius. It's too obvious. You're just gonna work it out straight away, and I'm gonna be left with a terribly deflated feeling of kind of, oh, all right, I thought it's clever. No, that's a bad idea. No audience interaction. Don't invite opinions from the general public. It's opening the gates of hell, David. Besides which, we haven't got the means.
But
to
they
do
might,
it.
They might, no... they might come up with a title that will give you a fresh inspiration that will actually inspire you to start writing tomorrow.
It's all gone to press. It's okay. I just haven't written a bloody show yet. Oh. Anyway, so you know what kind of company I'm going to be keeping with you in the Vuelta this year. I'm going to be beside myself with work and anxiety again.
So when does it start? Straight after the Vuelta?
Pretty much October, November. But, you know, it's quite intense because over 30 dates, I'm going to be touring, you know, 5 nights a week for 6 weeks.
Are you still doing doing one-man show?
Yeah. It's along the similar lines to the last one. So every year...
So to explain to people what the show was before, because there may be listeners that don't know, well, you did the first one, which was... What was the first one?
You saw iteration number 3, and you saw it as work in progress, and in a very small venue in South London. And by the time it was finished, you know, I was playing to over 1,000 people.
That's a lot of people.
West End and all that. And so it's a laugh. It is a theatrical. It's not an evening with. I'm not just sort of. And then there was that time, David and I. You know, it's not just chat about that. It's a carefully, I think, quite carefully constructed, humorous, entertaining theatrical evening, which is a bit like Never Strays Far. It just bumbles off into all sorts of random cultural connections, but always comes back and touches base with the Tour de France.
Yeah, it is. It's like you kind of use... I loved it. Because it does have that... Basically, it's Ned doing... theatrical, I was going to say, a dramatic and comedic tour through the Tour de France. From your experiences to actually what happened in the race with audio visual, with kind of stuff from the race on the screen, with props, it's the whole shebang. Literally you get to relive the Tour de France with being led through slightly surreally by Ned.
Plus terrible impressions. In the last show, I did a Dave Brailsford impression with a bald wig and some black glasses on. And it got worse and worse as the thing went on. But I did a show up in Edinburgh, and I was doing that bit, and I did a book signing afterwards, and the last person in the queue at the book signing was Dave Brailsford's brother, Andy, who went, "Oh, no!" I went, "No! Where were you sitting?" And he goes, "Only in the front row." And I went, "No, were you?" And he goes, and then he picked up his phone and he showed me all the pictures he'd taken of me imitating his brother. And I went, "Andy, don't you dare. And he said, "No, it's too late." And he'd already sent them to Dave. Like that. Dave Brailsford's message back to him was simply said, "Was he a twat?" Which Andy replied, no, it wasn't that bad.
It's all right. It was a piece of work to Miller as well. Don't worry about it.
Exactly. Everyone got it. Yeah.
Very good. So when's our next... So what race have we got next? So that's we've done Tour Down Under, then Middle Eastern races are kicking off. Argentina's going on now. Tour de San Juan. Have we got our man in Colombia? Is he able to give us some South American
intel? He's our man in Madrid. Matt Rendell, he came and stayed at my house for a week, which is quite a long time to have Matt Rendell stay.
That's a very long
house.
Time to have him in your house.
And he was, the reason he was doing that is because he was recording, so he's been in Europe actually, he was recording the audio book of his forthcoming Columbia book, the much heralded Columbia Espacion.
Oh, that'll be good.
So he's done the audio book of it, and that is there's a book launch coming up fairly soon, I think in March. At the Colombian Embassy in London. So, no, he's in Europe, but I'm sure he'll be all over it, so we can check in when the San Juan finishes and the Colombian races start, etc. And my bold prediction that I made on a page of the Roadbook website when I was asked to make three predictions for 2020 still holds good, namely that Peter Sagan will not win a single race in 2020. Stage one of Tour de San Juan has been and gone, and David, he finished in sixth place.
Why do you do it? Don't make predictions.
By the time you're listening to this podcast, it'll be already on its arse on the floor. That was good. I enjoyed that.
Yep.
Go and see to that dog that's been barking.
I know. His name's Miko. We got him from a home, and he's so damaged, the little guy. We have to takes a lot of TLC. Sitting here now, just whining. Yeah.
Like Froomey. He's like Froomey.
He's as fast. Yeah. He's amazing. All right. Very good.
All right, David. Take care.
See you soon.
See you later.
When you make decisions for your company, you look for the no-brainers. And if you have a lot of mailing to do, Stamps.com is the ultimate no-brainer. It streamlines your processes to make your business more efficient, which makes you less busy. Mail checks, invoices, legal documents, and everything you need to keep your business running with Stamps.com. Seamlessly connect with every major marketplace and shopping cart. Schedule package pickups and see your cheapest and fastest shipping options from different carriers. With rates up to 89% off USPS and UPS rates. And with the Stamps.com mobile app, you can take care of mailing and shipping wherever you are. Make the same no-brainer decision as over 1 million other businesses with Stamps.com. Sign up with code PROGRAM for a 4-week trial, plus free postage and a free digital scale. No long-term commitments or contracts. That's Stamps.com. Code PROGRAM.